Hi there.
I'm Eric Word Weaver Shervin, Goldie of the Ridgar Folk here in East Texas, and I would like to welcome you to The Raven's Call. This is a show where I ramble on about different heathen-related subjects, just kind of whatever strikes my fancy, sets my mind on fire at the time. Big UPG warning at the beginning of this episode, like always. This is just my approach on heathenry. I'm just one heathen here in the middle of East Texas, doing things my way. I base things around my tribal culture, my hearth culture, and the experiences and insights that I have had, the study that I've done over the years, just like the rest of you guys. That's all. It's just, this is my journey. So we've covered some. I just put a post up on the channel. I've got, like, this year alone in the past like 365 days, I think it said we've got something like 7,000 watch hours. And then I did the math on it, and lifetime for the channel since I started this thing, we're up to like 14,000 watch hours. It's crazy. It's awesome. So thank you guys. I love that. That was fantastic. So we're going to keep going as long as you guys are interested. Now, I will tell you guys, my schedule has been really wonky lately. With the whole COVID situation going around the world right now, the nature of the industry in which I work, my availability to film has become very scarce. And so that's why I'm having to fit these in where I can. I'm not getting to film ahead as much as I would like. This particular video is being filmed on the Saturday before it will go live. So that doesn't leave me a lot of editing time. It doesn't leave me a lot of wiggle room in case anything should go wrong. The last video that I did last week that went live, there was an edit issue in there that I missed an edit on. And I did not realize until a friend of mine said, hey, just to let you know, you had a hiccup in there where you had your countdown, told yourself to go back and hit a spot, and you didn't catch it. Even though I scrubbed that video like three or four times, it was like 3:30 in the morning when I did it, because I had to go into work in the middle of the night. Long story, and it's not worth explaining. But needless to say, when you work in the industry that I do, scheduling's weird, and you end up with a lot of stress and a lot of weird times. So I just do what I can with it and roll from there. But because of that, I haven't necessarily... Mosquitoes, the national bird of Texas. Because of that, I have... It's not really, the mockingbird is, but still, you get the picture. I forget some people in Texas, may not know that. But because of all of the scheduling malfunctions and whatnot, it has become more difficult to get dedicated filming time and to see things through to completion. So, I'm fitting them in where I can, guys. There may come a point here in the near future where I may end up missing a week just because of scheduling problems. So, if that's the case, please forgive, bear with me, and we'll... We'll just keep trucking along and do what we can do, okay? Housekeeping stuff before we get started. Guys, remember that all the subscriptions, all the thumbs up, all the interactions help to put the channel out there for people to see it that haven't seen it before. I've noticed an uptick in the numbers here recently, so we seem to have broken through to a new market somewhere, and people have kind of, have grown... The audience has grown in a direction that I wasn't expecting, which is really cool. It's awesome. I never expected to break 2,000. And so whenever I see us jump up another 20 or 30 people, I'm still thrilled. You know, I'm still looking at it person by person every time it comes up. I'm like, yay, I'm up to, 2,045. I'm going to log back on. And I'm like, I'm up to 2,048. That's awesome. Another person. That's cool. So just so you guys know, I do look at those things. I do track it. And while it's not a numbers game and a popularity game, I do like to see the engagement. I like to see what you guys have got going on. I try to engage with the comments as much as I can, but a lot of times they're more in-depth answers necessary, and I don't really have the dedicated time to go in there and give them the interaction that they're due. And then in some of those, I have a hard time tracking what you guys are saying per se. There's a couple of individuals who really get into deep conversations, or at least they try to, in the comment section. They would if I would fully engage and we'd have a really cool deep conversation, but I don't always have time for a really cool deep conversation like that. And these are kind of conversations that I think would do better in person, because I don't always follow where they're going with what they've said, because for some reason it doesn't translate to comment text very well. It's like, I know this made perfect sense in your head, but without the inflection and all of that, I can't really follow you. I need to see which part of this statement excites you. I need to see which part of this really drives your fire. So that's, keep that in mind when you guys make these comments and everything. I don't have the benefit of seeing inside your head. So sometimes I may not necessarily follow exactly where you're going with something. Something may be snarky and I won't realize it's supposed to be snarky, or something may be a really cool revelation. And because I'm missing the inflection, I'm missing the subtlety and the nuance of an actual verbal conversation, I may not necessarily know how to respond to it. And so I may, like, that may get tabled to come back to, and then I never get back to it because I've got 20 million other things to handle. And I completely meant to get back to that, wanted to get back to that, but couldn't. So anyway, you guys get the picture. Excuses aside, please interact, do everything you can. I love to see y'all get into conversations with each other. That's really cool, because then I can sit back and go, yeah, what he said, that was good. That's a good point right there. You know, because it's fun. I like to see, I like that fire. Use the community, use everything. Get in there and communicate with each other, make connections. That's what it's there for. Use the networking stuff and just really go to town, guys. Get to know each other and build a community out of it, since we've got quite an active little community. Now, without any further ado, let's go ahead and jump into today's subject. Today's subject is, it's not a viewer request, but it is a viewer inspired, okay? Getting into mosquito time here. It's viewer inspired because I was having some conversations in the comments and on Facebook, and I've run into a couple of individuals who I can tell are a little bit more maybe on the recon side of things than on my side of the kind of middle of the road organic approach. And but they make some very valid points, and that's always worth pointing out and always worth coming back to, is they make some very valid points that need to be explored. And one of the valid points that was made was, you know, I've made references, particularly back in my working with the Husfatir, that, you know, there's a lot of mention in folk tradition and in folk tales of Husfatir, but there's no mention in what we would consider actually arch-heathen texts, okay? And that we don't have necessarily documented evidence showing that the Husfatir predates Christian influences in Northern Europe. And I get it. I get what he's coming at. You know, yeah, it's there. Yes and no. yes and no. The specific incarnation of like Nissa and Tomta, no, that does not necessarily, I'm chasing bugs here, does not necessarily predate the Christian conversion in that form factor. There are mentions in the Heimskringla and in some of the others of household gods, much akin to how some of the Greeks and Romans would have household gods. There's one great battle that the tide of the battle is turned because this individual calls upon his family gods troll women, to troll wives, witches, as it were, to come and wield the power of the elements in combat against his foes. And it does indeed actually turn some of the combat. And this is, I believe that's in the Heimskringla. And so this is something that we see some in the sagas more than we see in like the Poetic Edda and the Prose Edda, because that's not what the Poetic and Prose Edda are about. You know, when we talk about sources, we have to remember the Poetic Edda only is it's the surviving bits of incomplete poems and makes up less than 2% of the entire belief structure of arch-heathens. It's very, very microscopic in the grand scheme of the mythos. Yes, it had some of the key elements, some of the most important elements, but there's a lot that didn't survive. There's a lot that didn't get written down. We get references in some of Snorri's work to poems that no longer exist, you know? References and kennings to no longer extant literary sources. And because of that, we can only surmise that they did exist and that there was more outside of the realm of just the Poetic Edda. Because we're not what I call a big book religion, and you guys caught on to that last week, the whole big book thing, because we're not a big book religion, there's not a steady handbook to go to and say, this is heathenry, this is heathen belief, this is it codified down into a handy dandy handbook manual, you know? just doesn't work that way. And so because of that, there's a lot of things that maybe didn't survive because it was an oral tradition. It was passed down. And that's part of the reason why I push so much to write things down. Yes, we are still going to do the oral tradition. We are still going to raise our kindreds and our tribes where we just tell them how things are done, where we show them hands-on how things are done. Very practical and pragmatic approach to doing enculturation and the survival of tribal culture. Absolutely spot on. That's how it needs to be done. Okay? I do not mean to minimize in any way, shape, form, or fashion the importance of pragmatic, hands-on, and oral tradition elements. You know, those are first and foremost the most important part of passing on tradition, okay? It may seem a bit skewed in the past because I have urged so heavily to write things down, and I still urge heavily to write things down because we're gonna do, that's what we do. We don't need a reminder to be doers. We don't need a reminder to say, hey, show your kids how to do ritual, you know, show the rest of your tribe how to do these things. Talk to each other about how to do these things because that's what you're gonna do. That's why you get together as a tribe in the first place, is because you want that common ground and that connection. So you're gonna do those things naturally. I don't need to do an episode on why you need to have practical and pragmatic application of tradition in order for those things to survive into enculturation. Even though I've done an episode on enculturation and extinguishment on a cultural level. So anyway, even though we've been there and done that, that's not necessarily the point. I do urge writing things down so that they will survive and that future generations don't have to play the guessing game like so many of us do. So that's why I really urge people to write down their traditions when they can, some context for those things, some individual experiences, and roll from there. I think there's a lot that can be learned and that will survive as a result of those kind of practices. Now, that's because we are creating sources now that will be used for future generations. And that's the thing that we need to keep in mind, is that we are creating sources. These are going to be primary sources for our future generations, because when it comes to how Hridgar, my tribe, does things, you're not going to find it in another book writing about how Hridgar does things. You're going to look at my writings and say, this is somebody in Hridgar saying how Hridgar does things. That becomes a primary source. I wrote it, and I am in Hridgar. I am one of the ones that helped to develop everything that is in the tradition and thew of this. So as a result, this becomes a primary source. The poetic Edda and the prose Edda are tertiary sources at best. And because of that, there's a lot that may not survive, and there's a lot that gets lost to interpretation, a lot that gets lost to syncretism. And because I'm the one writing my stuff, and it's a first person, first party, you know, primary source, there's no outside interpretation, there's no outside rose-colored glasses, there's no syncretism with a secondary culture looking at how my tribe does things and then trying to understand it within the context of their own cultural thews and norms, which is largely what we see when we see syncretism in these works. They're trying to understand it from within the context of their own worldview, and because the worldviews are so disparate, there are significant discrepancies between the two, which leads to a disjointed and disconnected understanding of the primary culture that you are studying in the first place. So, that was a long sentence, but you guys get what I was getting at there, I hope. So, when people talk to me about, you know, yeah, okay, stuff like the Nisa, stuff like the Tomta, they're not existent in the pre-Christian conversion sources. Well, that's because there aren't any pre-Christian conversion sources. The Poetic Edda was compiled far, far after after the conversion, and the Prose Edda was well after. I mean, that's Snorri Sturluson, who's a Christian monk who, you know, was writing this. You gotta remember too what the sources are meant to do, you know? The Poetic Edda is not a cohesive document. It's not. It's excerpts from the Codex Regius that include the stories of Norse mythology, particularly northern Scandinavia, northern mainland Europe, not even necessarily the views of mainland Europe, Anglo-Saxon heathens, German, like Germany area heathens, I don't know, Germanic in nature, but you guys get the picture as far as regionalization and differences in belief structure. I mean, this, they're not reflective. They're not, they don't globalize. And so the Poetic Edda is a wonderful source. It's one of the only ones that we have pertaining to the stories of our gods and how that is passed down in written form. Same thing with Snorri Sturluson's Prose Edda, which he wrote because he was a fan of Skaldic poetry, and Skaldic poetry means nothing without the context of the original mythology upon which all the kennings are based. So you've got to remember why particular sources exist and how those were recorded. None of the ones that we have are primary sources written down by the original arch heathens, because they didn't write anything down. Okay, now we've been ranting about this particular subject before, but when it comes to things like Tomta, Nisa, and other fae folk, and we're talking about heavy focus on the spiritual side of things, you've got to remember too, look at what the Prose Edda and the Poetic Edda both focus on. You're going to find a heavy, heavy influence of the gods and the religious side of things, the worship of the deities and the gods, not the superstitions of the individuals as far as household practices and localized lesser gods. You're not going to see a lot of mention of the Vaetir. You're not going to hear a lot of mention of them going down and making offerings to the river spirit in order to bless them with a bountiful harvest of fish this coming season when the salmon goes swimming or whatever. You're not going to see that necessarily, because that's not what those sources focused on. You know what I'm getting at? Because those sources didn't focus on it, nobody else wrote it down. So we have to look for where those things survive. And they survive in echoes in modern stuff. And one of the wonderful wonderful sources where you can look at some hidden gems as far as traditions and folk belief goes are things like the Grimm Brothers and their fairy tales, because the Grimm Brothers fairy tales are folk tales that were told throughout, you know, the mainland Europe area, particularly Germany, and were passed down from generation to generation until the Brothers Grimm sat down and actually codified those things into a written hard text of these fairy tales, and with them a lot of the folk traditions and superstitious belief that goes along with that. You can also look at law systems. You can look at the Grey Goose Laws and some of the other laws, especially laws in Iceland post-conversion, because those laws will give you an indication of some of the things that are not cool to Christians because they were particularly heathen, like the worshiping of trees is expressly prohibited. Why is it expressly prohibited? Because we can surmise from that a lot of heathen practices took place in groves, like our vases and things like that. There were the use of trees as center focuses of religion, as totemic focal points within a religious practice, and especially if there's heavy symbolism of a tree working within like a tree well paradigm, things like that, that, you know, would come across to a Christian as, oh, they're worshiping trees. Because you got to remember, it's a difference in worldviews, and ancient Christians heavily thought that anyone who utilized an idol of any kind was actually worshiping the idol, not understanding the mechanics of the fact that the idol itself serves as a conduit to the divine, and that it's not necessarily worshiping the idol, but using the idol to worship the deity. And that's something that gets lost in people that don't understand what a totem or an idol are used for and how that works. You know, they want to globalize to, well, they're worshiping an idol, false idols, blah, blah, blah. And that's not how it works. You know, that's not what metaphysically and spiritually and religiously is occurring in this particular instance. So, one, we've got that the original sources, Poetic Edda and Prose Edda, largely deal with the sacred elements, not with the profane elements, such as things like we're dealing with as far as housewives and with some of our lesser traditions. Two, you've got to look at surviving superstitions and see where you can find records of those. And then another point they brought up was the whole archaeological aspect of things. And actually, archaeological aspects do indicate the presence of in-home altars, dedicated spaces that seem like they would be dedicated to a house god of some sort. So, yeah, there's definitely the support of hearth gods. Now, I see the view, the modern view of Tomte and Nisa as kind of a watered down version of the hearth gods. Because somebody asked in one of the questions online, how do you go about choosing a spirit to elevate to hearth god? Because that was kind of what I was, it was an interpretation of kind of how I went about it in the video, and I see how that needed some clarification as a result. So here's some clarification. It's not necessarily that you elevate something to a hearth god. You recognize, you invite in a spirit, the spirit of the home, the spirit itself that takes up residence in the home. You recognize it and begin to show it respect and veneration. And then it will continue to grow in strength with its relationship with you. So even then, a lot of times what I find is people will just start hailing the hearth god, the god of the hearth, the god of the home, without knowing its name, without necessarily knowing what it is, but you know that it is the spirit and the vitality of the house. And so you begin pouring energy into that, giving it a dedicated space, and then together with it, you begin building an identity by which you know this thing in that space. And eventually you come up with a name, or not. You don't necessarily have to, although it is a sign of respect to be able to do so. To choose a name for them is an honor. They are honored by your choosing of said name, especially if said name is something that brings honor to them, is glorifying, and is appropriate, shows a level of interaction and knowledge, a personal connection. There's a lot of strength in that. So that's a beautiful thing. So, but again, we're not here to talk about who's fit here today. We're here to talk about sources and what those sources mean. So I think it's extremely important that we remember that folk tales and folk traditions are a bastion of old traditions, old thews, old belief structures that may be lost to time otherwise. Because when you're dealing with something as simple as, you know, the fae folk, it's not simple, but as far as breaking it down into that kind of singular terminology, if you're dealing with something like the fae folk, belief structures are actually fairly complex and buried deep within different practices. You know, the horseshoe over the door, running water, salt on the windows, things like that. There's a lot of different elements that go into these things that you're not necessarily going to see in a primary or tertiary source. And what about the Icelandic sagas? Yeah, the Icelandic sagas were written down after the fact, guys. I mean, that wasn't written down by Icelanders in the time. It does focus on a period of time, and there are some things from which they can pull because that's post-conversion time and people did start writing things down. So there's a lot there. There's a lot of accuracy in the Icelandic sagas. More and more accuracy we are finding as archaeological digs are reinforcing specific mentions of specific events and locations within the sagas, and therefore are giving credence to the veracity of the sagas themselves. So there are plenty of superstitious elements that are present in the Icelandic sagas, especially if you get into things like the draugr and the practices that go along with that. And we use that in our research later on, coupled with you know, different laws that we've seen, different folk traditions and superstitions that go around, that we can kind of piece together what an arch-heathen view regarding something like the draugr might be. It is still a guess. So all we can do is build what we think might be, and then make our own observations and our own study of the world and figure out, okay, well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that, because there's a lot of things that arch-heathens didn't fully understand either. You've got to remember, we have advancements in technology and in science that would be magic to them. So there's a lot that we will understand better from a scientific terminology, but we have to make the correlation to the superstitious belief in order to understand what was going on there. And then by virtue of that and understanding that we are gaining greater in understanding of the world that the gods gave us and with the gifts that the gods provided us to do so, by doing all of this, we begin to build a better understanding of this phenomena and maybe go even deeper into it, because we are fueled both with the metaphysical symbolism and the metaphoric symbolism that go along with the superstitious side of things that can help to inform the scientific approach as well. And then we can use the two of those to build deeper understandings of things. But anyway, take for example, I want to give a good example of where folk tradition exists in a modern setting, but is it does give some ties to some pre-Christian traditions, but only survive in like one specific area in the specific traditions of a specific people, all right? And this is the Pennsylvania Dutch. If you look into the Pennsylvania Dutch, you will find that they have a lot of heathen tradition that still survives in their practice. A lot of folk tradition that passed down through the generations because they are more from the German and Danish side of things coming into it. I'm not a professional when it comes to the Pennsylvania Dutch, but I have done some study enough to be fascinated with certain elements of their society. And one of the things that absolutely fascinates me, other than the fact that they use some charms that are very reminiscent of like the Merseburg charm, which is a healing charm, and there's some other spells that are kept within there. Great sources for some kind of magical thinking as well. Some of the tradition, the thews that go along with the superstitious thought, which do inform a worldview. But their hex signs are a fascinating thing. They are it's an art style that is built around a concentric circle and the symbolism of the different images that are placed upon this circular plaque or the circular plane. It bestows certain blessings. It's a pictograph and a focal point for magical working. So it is it's very much a magical practice, a psychic practice, and a very cultural thew practice. And it's something that's passed down specifically within this culture as far as the hex signs go. You can go through and see things that have a very kind of... there's a specific art style that goes along with it. And it's the reason I sometimes mention the Danish part of it, because there are... I still see some elements of this art style in modern Danish works, as well as in some of the more classic Danish-German works, things like that. So, but this is a source. It's an actual, like, living, breathing entity that is, I mean, they're not like Amish or anything like that, but it does have that kind of element of, there's a little hiccup, a little pocket where this wasn't completely snuffed out, and these people still practice this particular tradition. Now, does that mean that that globalizes to pre-Christian tradition and that heathens practiced hex signs across Northern Europe? Probably not. I'm going to be perfectly honest. I seriously doubt that. I think we would see a lot more reference to it. I think we would see a lot more survival of the tradition. But I do think that it shows a continuity of thought style and some elements of the superstitious side of things surviving in a modern era with a very specific cultural tradition. It is a very specific cultural tradition, but it is fed and fueled by some superstitious belief that I do believe has some pre-Christian roots to it. Now, again, I'm not a professor of anthropology, looking into specifically the history of the Pennsylvania Dutch. But there's definitely some very strong heathen elements. You can go out and research, Pennsylvania Dutch hex signs, and you will find plenty, because there's a lot of research done on it. There's a lot of studies done on it. And I know some people who have tried to kind of capture that kind of tradition and bring it into their own tribes, because it is such a neat thing, and it's very warding, very blessing in the way that these symbols are used, but they're very complex. It's kind of like using a sigil of warding and blessing, but blending it into almost a coat of arms kind of thing. It's really kind of cool. So anyway, the moral of all of this, to bring everything to full bear in all of this, is to say that, yeah, guys, I get it. There's a lot of things that we do not have specific ties to in arch-heathen times. I get that. I understand that despite everything, there's some things that we just don't have sources on, and things like the Húsvetir are an example of that, references to the Vætir, references to how we do some of the things within groves and within some of the traditions that only appear in later sources or that we have figured out in our own practices over time. I get that. But that's because not everything was written down. It doesn't mean that it doesn't exist before the conversion. It also does not mean that even if it was born after the conversion, that it is not still a valid heathen practice. All right, it depends on where you're coming from on the whole hardcore reconstructionist element, or if you are more fluffy bunny neo-pagan, or if you're like me, that's more of what I would like to call an organic tribal heathen. For the organic growth, you know, the basis of the tree, you know, mosquitoes. The roots in history plus growing towards future, allowing for some free growth, some good development, new things, new explorations, all of this. Important aspects to the survival of a culture and the survival and the thriving of a culture. Okay? So, think about why, the whys, you know? Think about why the source on this needs to be important. Think about, you know, don't get stuck on the I am only trying to recreate the traditions of my ancestors and new additions are not, you know, welcome, because then we're not talking about like Renfair or something like that. We're not talking about we're not talking about trying to go back and specifically play Viking reenactment, all right? That's not what we're doing in this. We're trying to, at least my tribe I know, is trying to find our way of heathenry in the modern day. I know some tribes are more reconstructionist and trying to go back and find things within a context of ancient sources and ancient traditions. But, you know, understand the why. You know, if that is a thing for you, if you are a hardcore recon and you need primary sources going back to a certain specific date and time to be able to link things, then okay, I get it. I understand. That's your point. What I'm telling you is that no, I'm not going to come and say, yes, here is a source that puts that correlates Tomte and Nissa to the hearth god, and this is a pre-Christian thing that lacks that is all tied up neatly in this particular source material. I'm not going to do that, because that's not the process of how I got there. I'm not trying to go back and grab something from the past and give it a point, like an image now. I'm not going back to take a snapshot of this and bring it into my house now. What I'm trying to do is continue to grow. And this is something that has grown through those traditions over the years and taken on numerous different versions, numerous different incarnations and flavors. So, you know, keep that in mind. You've got to remember, I'm not a hardcore recon. And so I'm not going to come at it in a lot of ways that a hardcore recon might. I am serious about my research. I am serious about my interpretations and my whys. I think my whys are extremely important to me, but they are mine, just like your whys are going to be important to you. You know, again, not my haul, not my call. You guys approach it the way that you want to, but, you know, in sharing my way and my for the channel, you know, my heathenry, my whys are important to me. And that's why I urge people to think about your whys. Why do you need this to be this way? Why do you need a source for this? Why do you need to be 100% certain that this is an arch-heathen thing? Are you doing this because you are trying to be hardcore reconstructionist and reconstructing things at a specific date and time? Well, then, yeah, you're going to knock away a lot of the fantastic elements, because there's no literary archaeological evidence to back some of these things up. There is on some of it, but not all of it. And so there's going to be a lot of things that you cut away. Or is your why that you are rebelling against, through some kind of baggage, the idea that this could be even like 2% syncretic with Christianity or post-Christian traditions and practices, and that because of that you are rejecting it outright because you feel like there's no place for this within heathenry because it might be tainted. Heathenry never was pure. There's not a pure heathenry. It's a varied thing with different elements, just like each tribe had its own way of doing things and their own traditions. Each individual person would come at things differently. So, you know, I don't know that necessarily needs to be your why. I mean, it may be your why. You may be in that position where you need to rebel against everything that, you know, came before because you were tied to a big book religion, and therefore you're at a point in your own spiritual development or religious development where you need to shun everything that even possibly could have anything to do with the previous life in order to create comfort in your new life. I get that. That's maybe where you're at, and I respect that. That's not where I am. So it doesn't matter to me if there's maybe a little bit of syncretism there. If the why is important and it jives with my heathen worldview, if it jives with the way that I see the world working and my understanding of things, then yeah, okay. And the idea of like Hosfatir, correlating with Tomten Nissa does jive heavily with the way that I see folk tradition and the survival of these traditions in the modern era. So, make of that what you will, guys. Thank you guys for watching. I really do appreciate it. I thank you all for you know, being there and supporting the channel, interacting, sharing it around, popping it up on different formats and different places. I dig it. I've noticed it's come up from Reddit a few times, and every time I see that I go, let me go look and see what's being said. Because Reddit's one of those places that can either be really cool or can be a cesspool. Just depends entirely upon the group and what kind of, whether they're asshats or they're cool people. You know, it varies and it depends. So that's one of those things. If you're gonna share stuff out on different formats and whatnot, go for it. Be my guest. I'm all for it. It's fantastic. You may pop a line on the group page and be like, hey, just so you guys know, we're on Reddit now. Or, I'm doing over here. You don't have to. It doesn't matter. It's just kind of interesting for me to be able to go back and look. And like with Reddit, I have to go search Reddit every time to see where I am and whether or not people are coming to the channel through Reddit because of new posts or old posts. Because there's a couple of old posts on there, several old posts. And then Go the Grimwolf went out and added like three or four more to it. And it was like, oh, okay, well, that's where that batch came from. That's kind of cool. So anyway, you know, guys, I just wanted you to know, I appreciate it. I really do. Thank you so much. Feel free to share it wherever you want. Carte blanche, share the videos out, all that fun stuff. That's what they're there for. If you guys are still interested, I am still doing up the audio podcast version of things. So that all still is a thing and it is still going on. It goes up the same Wednesday as the video. Sometimes later, because I'll get up and go, oh yeah, I haven't converted that for the audio format yet. So yeah, it's not always 100% on the timing there, but I try. It's just, again, lots going on. And when I get things buttoned up and the video finished, what I'll do is I'll rip the audio from that to do the audio version of the podcast. And it only takes me about 15, 20 minutes to make the conversion. But I do actively have to think about making the conversion. So, you know, if it's not up right when the new video comes up, bear with me. Plus, some of those podcatchers need some time to aggregate before new podcasts will pop up. So, I'm going to try and stay on schedule as much as I can. But do remember, like I said, things get kind of crazy. And with the COVID world the way it is right now, I may or may not be on schedule. Okay? So anyway, thank you all. Hail to you. May your hearth fires burn bright.